When I was a little kid, I loved monsters, particularly Frankenstein, Wolfman, Dracula, and most especially like Godzilla. And I thought that they were real, and dinosaurs were real, and I thought actors got to hang out with monsters all the time. Little did I know how truthful that statement was, but in a different way. But I thought if I became an actor, that I was around 5, 6 years of age, I would be able to hang out with Godzilla in real life. And, of course, as I got older, just like people who play baseball or something like that, the more I acted, the more I realized I would not be able to hang out with monsters, and also that I was more and more incapable of doing anything else.
And how did you work your way into this niche, this character actor thing? Was there a point to where you realized, hey, I think I can make a career out of this?
I didn't get into the niche. The niche got into me. I think when I was studying, even at the U of I, I was thinking that what my career was going to be was like a serious, legitimate actor, the serious, legitimate stage on Broadway, and I would play romantic roles and all this kind of stuff. And then I started losing my hair. And when you lose your hair, you kind of start to go into that niche. I think that's the first part of your question, is that physically, you know, when you lose your hair and you're tall or goofy looking, you become a character actor. The second part of your question is, how did I kind of make it a niche, or the niche make me? I was able to get more and more work because I had studied real acting and at the U of I and at SMU, and had developed acting abilities at those places. And so I was able to be a team player. I could do drama. I could do comedy. Not a lot of people can do comedy, so that's always a commodity. I knew how to set up the joke, and I knew how to get the joke if I needed to. I knew how to do exposition if I needed to do that. I was a good team player. I was a good sixth man on a basketball team. You could send me in and I could pass or block the shot, whatever you needed me to do.
Before we get too far into your career, didn't know until recently about your musical aspirations, or at least did you have some at one point?
Yes. You know, and I think it's so funny, as I look at human nature and I look back at my life, I see that everybody always thinks of their lives from the top down. You know, so when you buy a guitar, you're thinking of what the album cover is going to be on your 12th album. So when I worked all summer with my Uncle Jaime so I could buy a guitar, and I ended up playing with a couple friends of mine in high school, and we had this really kind of goofy, folky, groupie, not very goody, but we were picked to be one of these garage bands of Dallas that was going to cut an album. And the guy who was really the head of the group, Bobby Foreman, had this friend who had this friend named Stevie Ray Vaughan, and said, this kid's really a good guitar player. Maybe he could play on the record with us. And so a 14-year-old Stevie Ray Vaughan actually played on our garage band record in Dallas. And it turns out to be, it's the first extant recording of Stevie Ray Vaughan ever. I think I sold one of those albums on the internet for like $450 for a school fundraiser. But Stevie, even back then, was amazing. But I remember at the time, I had a new girlfriend. It was like 1970. And I was saying, I may not end up doing this acting thing. I may just be going the role of the rock and roll thing. That just may not be the Academy Award, you know, may be the Grammy Award instead. And somehow the truth always ends up managing to be in the trampoline in between.
I heard a voice last night.
What was the name of your band?
Oh, God, you are going to humiliate me. It's A Cast of Thousands. And the reason we called it A Cast of Thousands was because at the time we framed this band, is when the great big movie spectaculars existed, where they always advertised it having a cast of thousands. So that's how we got that highly innovative name.
So did acting pull you away from it quickly, or did the band just kind of fizzle out after a little while?
Yeah, the band in a way fizzled out. I started getting regular acting work where they paid me money in Dallas at a real theater. And so I started thinking, oh, I'm making money at this. And then I became like one of their young leading men. I became one of their leading young leading men, again, because I could do comedy. And I became, Tobolowsky never can become a household word, but I became kind of for a couple of years a guy who was always the young guy at this theater company's plays. And I began to have faith in myself. When somebody pays you, you begin to have faith that you can, in fact, get paid. And so I thought, well, I will go the path of the least resistance.
You went to SMU, and when did you graduate from there?
Boy, 73.
So how long between there and coming to Champaign-Urbana?
I came to Champaign-Urbana, it looks like probably at the end of 75 and through the summer of 76.
Well, you explained it in one of your podcasts. I mean, you pretty much needed another gig, and you were extended the invitation for you to come up here.
Well, yeah, it was... my girlfriend and I was very much in love, and being in love will really affect your life. Like, say you're an igneous rock, you fall in love, and you will become a metamorphic rock. You know, with enough heat and pressure, you will change your ways. And my desire to go to Broadway and be a babe on Broadway was mitigated by the fact that my girlfriend was not getting a lot of opportunities to act. Something like 22 graduate schools wanted me, and like three wanted her. And then the head of the SMU theater department came up and said, Stephen, why don't you and Beth come to the University of Illinois? So I thought, well, I could stay here in Dallas and be a big fish in a small pond and hope that eventually I get some career going. Or I could continue my life with Beth, with Hobb, our mentor, sort of, in a totally new place and go to school. And we did that. And, of course, as it turned out, you know, Beth ended up having, like, one of the greatest careers of anyone on Earth and became world famous, and it just shows you how much other people know. We came to Illinois as just kind of really a last straw, as a matter of desperation of staying together and still working on theater together.
We walked across campus. Now, it had two defining elements. One, the University of Illinois was huge, whereas SMU only had around 5,000 students at this time. The University of Illinois had 35,000. The second thing I noticed was that the entire campus smelled like doo-doo. As Beth and I walked in, taking in the enormity of the place, she looked at me and squinched up her face and said, "This place stinks." I said, I know, and we both stopped and looked at the bottom of our shoes. Nothing. We walked over to the brand new Kranitz Center of the Arts, where we would be teaching and hopefully acting in plays, and it was amazing. Beautiful, huge, new theaters, outdoor amphitheater, dance studios. It was a palace. And we met John Ahart, who was the tall, sweet, affable head of the directing curriculum. He shook my hand vigorously and said, "So, here are Hobbs' chosen ones. Nice to meet you two. I think you'll be happy here, because we're certainly very happy to have you." I nodded and said, "Yes, it's all a little overwhelming." John laughed and said, "The new building or the smell?" And I said, "Well," and John said, "Yeah, at this time of the year, the university smells like shit. Actually, it's pretty interesting. It's the trees. You see, the entire campus was planted with ginkgo trees, and they're prehistoric. They predate the evolution of using bees to pollinate. They use flies. So the smell is actually an ingenious biological mechanism of attraction." Amazing, huh? I said, "Yeah, in an odd way, it's proof that there's a God. So how long does this smell last?" He said, 6 weeks. I go, "Well, they sure don't mention this in the brochure."
So tell me about your experience on campus. I mean, it certainly led to some interesting stories, as you've been telling us, internet, people subscribing to your podcast.
It's funny. You know, when I started the podcast, which is the Tobolowsky Files, slashfilm.com wanted me to do a lot of movie stories, because that's what people thought, but a story will become whatever it'll become. You know, you can't really control what you need to write about. In my days at Illinois, I never really had fashioned into a story until this podcast opportunity came up, and then I realized it was perfect for a story. Because when I was going into the U of I, going into Illinois, I thought, what the heck am I doing here? I hated school. I didn't have a great time in school. And now why am I doing more class scenes, more study of 18th century acting styles, more term papers? Why am I doing this? You know, I want to be in New York acting. As I look back now, I was completely misguided, because the threads of everything that kind of made me successful and the threads of everything that kind of made me framed who I am today, I kind of learned at Illinois. But I was unaware of it at the time. Illinois taught me a lot of lessons about what is important and what is not important in being successful in show business. It taught me how to cope with failure. It taught me how to stick to my guns, regardless what the pressures were on the outside. It taught me that you could never finish the process of being a student. Are you on the campus of Illinois now?
Yes. Yeah, we're the NPR station on campus.
Fabulous. Here is a message that I learned at the University of Illinois. I want to send out to all the students out there at Illinois, and it's one of the most important things I learned there. I witnessed it with my own two eyes. There are two groups of people in the world. There are people who think they are masters, and there are people who think they're students. It's much better in life to be a student. And I saw so many of my compatriots at the University of Illinois, as soon as they graduated, as soon as they were going through graduate school, they shut down and they said, okay, I don't need to learn anymore. What the University of Illinois taught me is that to be successful, you have to continue learning your entire life. And that doesn't mean stay in school. Don't be a perpetual student. But it means when you get in the real world, you have to be a student of life, or the train will leave you at the station. And that is one of the most vital things I ever learned. I learned it at U of I.
You talked about being a student. I mean, and I look at some directors you worked with. I mean, Christopher Nolan, John Carpenter, Ridley Scott, Mel Brooks, Stephen Frears, just to name a few. Have you picked up some things from films you've made, or maybe some of the big name actors you've co-starred with?
Oh, always. I mean, every film I learn something, and it's never the thing you think you're going to learn. In the most obvious sense of what you're talking about, when I was working on Mississippi Burning, I was supposed to be there for 2 weeks, and I ended up there for 10 weeks, because a lot of my scenes, I was head of the Ku Klux Klan in that film, a lot of my scenes were exteriors, and we had a lot of thunderstorms moving through Mississippi. So just because of weather, I was hanging out a lot, and Alan Parker came up to me and said, Stephen, I hear you're interested in directing. While you're hanging around, do you want to follow me around and watch me do what I do? And I went like, oh, sure. Yeah, I guess that happens all the time, that like one of the world's leading directors just says, follow me around. So I started following Alan around. And then after a couple weeks of going everywhere he went, watching him do something, he would turn to me all of a sudden and say, how would you shoot this scene? And I would go, I would do this, 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 this. He goes, wrong. You would do this, 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 this. And it got more intense as it went along. I got to tell you, it was a life gift. And I was able to thank Alan years later. I was able to kind of hug him and thank him, not realizing what a great gift he had given me with the benefit of a life's knowledge. And I think I made him very angry. A lot of the lessons you learn are life lessons. You learn unusual things sometimes. Sometimes, like in Bossa Nova, where I'm in Brazil in Rio de Janeiro for a month. It just happened. Talk about walking between the raindrops. the last day I was in Rio is when their economy collapsed. And the money I had fortunately cashed in, the money they had paid me, otherwise my whole salary would have gone down the drain. And a week after I left Rio, drug gangs came into our hotel and shot up the restaurant and the bar where I used to hang out all the time with machine guns. You learn a lot of things. And then, like, in a silly way, in Bird on a Wire, I had to do a fight with Mel Gibson. And in Bird on a Wire, Mel says, Stephen, do you do these fights a lot? And I go, no, sir. He says, well, I do. I do a lot of them. And let me give you a little advice. The main thing you have to remember is not to make punching sounds with your mouth, like going pow, 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 sha. Because as kids, as boys, he says, we always grow up and we pretend to fight and we make those noises. And I'll be damned. You know, we started fighting. We fought for about 10, 12 hours that day, pretend fighting. But you get tired and suddenly, you know, Mel would go, yeah, or pow, or I would do it. We both just start laughing. And, you know, you learn odd things that way.
I would guess that the most recognizable role might be Groundhog Day.
Gotta be.
But do you have a favorite, one that maybe that stands out for you, that maybe you were able to show your talents the most?
I am most proud. Oh, okay, let's get it straight. I love Groundhog's Day. I love Ned. Ned's recognized all over the world. Great movie, great character. It's going to be a classic. But the role that I'm most proud of, believe it or not, is the role of Sammy Jenkins in Memento. With Chris. That was the most difficult role I ever had. And the reason was I played someone with amnesia. And I never really realized it till I got on the set. But when you have amnesia, you don't really remember what you're doing. You can't remember. And the cornerstone of what an actor uses to survive is memory. It is his memory that brings him from point A to point B, from the beginning of the scene to the end of the scene. And so I had a choice because Chris wanted us to, quote, improvise and improvise dialogue, that I had to, on one part of my brain, not remember anything I did, and in the other part of my brain, remember everything I did so that when Chris moved in for coverage, I would be able to match it. And it was the most difficult challenge I ever had. And the film and Sammy survives very well under those conditions, and the film is just brilliant. So I'm very proud of that. That was the toughest thing I ever had to do.
Well, I got to mention Glee, because, I mean, I love the concept of, like, a musical TV show, and I know you're getting ready to shoot some more.
Yeah.
Do you get to sing and dance anymore?
That's a great question. You know, I did one. I did I Want to Sex You Up. And then I did a recording with Lea Michele of another number, which got cut from the show. So, of course, being an actor, I'm just assuming that I stunk. And I may have. But you know, I did a musical video the other night for the show with Lea. But they used me primarily for comedy and not for singing. So I don't know. It's an adventure. Glee is an adventure. First of all, Glee is not a normal show because so many of the people on Glee are Broadway actors. And so you really have this stage feeling doing Glee as opposed to a film feeling. Everybody is always working. Nobody is goofing off. Everybody is rehearsing and running to record their songs and doing dance rehearsals and getting off in a corner and practicing their dances by themselves. So it is really like doing a Broadway play every 10 days.
Ah, tick-tock, you don't stop.
Stop to the
ah, tick-tock, you don't stop.
Stop to the ah, tick-tock, you don't stop.
I know you're not going to sing that song.
Ah, tick-tock, you don't stop. To the ah, tick-tock, you don't stop. To the ah, tick-tock, you don't stop.
I know you're not going to sing that song.
Come inside, take off your coat, I'll make you feel at home. Let's pour a glass of wine.